I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The last time Lawrence Krauss was on the show, we talked about nothing. More specifically, his book, A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. Krauss is a theoretical physicist, and he's got a new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, that picks up where the last book left off to answer the question, why are we here? He traces the discoveries that have revolutionized our understanding of the universe and shares his passion for the questions that science looks to answer. He also takes we human beings off our pedestal, saying our existence is a curious cosmic accident and the universe was not made for us. He is the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
I mean, science over centuries has been under attack. I'm thinking of Galileo and other scientists that had to defend themselves against whoever. What kind of attack is science, or excuse me, what kind of attack is science under today?
Well, there are a variety of forms of attack, I suppose. One in this country happens to be that science should be the basis of public policy, and it's quick, which means by science I mean reliance on empirical evidence and then testing and reason. And the current government doesn't seem to be involved in any of that. And it's really – there'll be a march for science, actually, in April 22nd. But I think the idea is that we scientists shouldn't be making public policy, but public policy should be based on science. And so and a healthy democracy depends upon an informed electorate. And one of the problems with all this world of alternative facts stems from the fact that we tend to teach science incorrectly. We teach it as a bunch of facts that people have to remember. That's not what science is at all. It's a process for deriving facts. It's a process for skeptical inquiry, testing, and constantly questioning yourself. And if we taught science more as sort of a series of questions in school and how to answer questions rather than facts, we used to in the old days, schools were for learning information, but right now my cell phone has more information than – but it also has more information. And what we really have to teach people is a filter. And in the modern world, too many people don't have that filter. And science is very useful for that. And as I say, unless we have an informed electorate, then we can't expect to have an informed legislature. And then we have what we have now, which is unfortunately a government that denies the existence of things that are incontrovertible, such as climate change.
Well, climate change, evolution. I mean,
only I think the vice president is the major person in the government right now denies evolution. But in any case,
well, in fact, you've said that really being wrong is a part of being part of science is being wrong. But that progress is about that inquiry. It's about trying to figure out why we're wrong.
That's why the story is called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, by the way. The so far is the key word because the story of science changes. It gets better all the time, and it gets better because we learn things. And learning things involves being wrong a lot of the time, and that's why the story changed. That's why it's not like that other greatest story, which sort of was written down and never changed. Ours gets more interesting. And, if you're a theoretical physicist, the two – best states to be in are either wrong or confused.
And I mean, most of them.
Yeah.
And happily so.
Happily, yeah.
Well, you write about a number of things in this book, but also your passion for physics, your sort of discovery of what this meant to you.
Well, I think the story is an amazing story, and it should be shared more broadly. Science is really a central part of our culture. Right? Science, I often say science suffers from the fact that it produces technology because people say, that's nice, but will it make a better toaster? But questions such as why are we here? Are we alone in the universe? All of these questions are questions everyone asks. And science, like art, music, and literature, changes our perspective of our place in the cosmos. It shares that aspect of human culture. And for me, that's the wonder of science and why I want to share it more broadly. Because, the funny thing is people say, well, I can't do science. But the amazing thing is, people don't say, well, you have to be a guitarist to enjoy Eric Clapton or a painter to enjoy Picasso. And so for some reason, we can enjoy the other arts without being experts. And, of course, the more we know, the more we enjoy them. And in science, I think it's really important to realize that we can all enjoy it. We all are scientists at a basic level. We all ask those questions. we tend to beat it out of people in high school, but
things like why are we here?
Exactly, like why? That's a transcendental question that, and like in my last book, why is there something rather than nothing? And the point is, science can address that, and too often religion has usurped those questions, and it doesn't really give an answer except to say because. And in some sense, the really important part of the why questions is how. How do we get here? And the amazing thing, the story that I tell is really a story of human inquiry and bravery and red herrings. And often when you're reading the story, you want to sort of shake people and say, look, you've got
what
the answer.
What were you thinking, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that human story is really important. And I enjoyed obviously, I knew the physics. I thought I knew the physics before I wrote the book. But the human story, and you know, often we present science as sort of a fait accompli, the logical final state. But to get to that logical final state, there's a long and winding road, and that long and winding road can be fascinating. And I begin with actually Plato, because one of the things that's amazing about this story is how we've unveiled a universe that's really an illusion. The universe of our existence is really not, does not represent the universe at its fundamental scales, which is why, by the way, the universe isn't designed for us, because fundamental laws of physics, if they weren't at a fundamental scale, they wouldn't even allow us to exist. It's only because of this accident, this field froze in the early history of the universe that allowed us to be here, that allowed the forces that we measure to be the forces as we measure them, and the particles that make us up to have mass. And the example I use in the book is that of an ice crystal on a window. If you look at the beautiful pattern of ice crystals from the outside, you can see the pattern. But if you were living on one of those crystals, the spine of that crystal, it would be very special. Your universe would have a direction in a sense that everything would depend on that direction. And physicists in that crystal would explain why the universe had that direction. And theologians would explain why God intended that direction to be important. And, of course, it's an accident. And much of what we see and think of as special in our universe, including the fact that stars and galaxies exist and we exist and maybe aliens exist, really is an accident. And it's an amazing accident that we should celebrate. But we're kind of a cosmic afterthought.
Well, let me pick up on the title of your book. There was a 1965 film about the life of Jesus, the greatest story ever told. You obviously are playing with some of that, and you do include Bible passages to start each chapter.
Yes.
It's also Exodus and Genesis and Revelation.
Are the three sections of the book.
So are you playing with
I'm playing
the
with
Bible?
That. Well, yeah. I mean, the Bible in that movie was called The Greatest Story Ever Told, and Easter's coming up, which is a nice time for the book to be coming out. And what I wanted to do, I wanted to play with that because I wanted to show how the real story of the universe is really the greatest story ever told. And
a better story than
it's
the story
much more,
of Jesus?
Of course, it's much more interesting. In fact, it's much more reminiscent in some sense of the great epics, the Odyssey and Iliad, in the sense that there's so much more surprise. That's really the key aspect, that we're constantly surprised. And as I say, the story keeps changing. But the human aspect is there, and as I say near the end of the book, we have two choices when we try and address these things. We can assume that the universe is made for us, or we can just go where the evidence takes us. And the latter story, I think, is much more humble as well as more interesting, because it doesn't assume that our existence is required for the universe, but it also means that we're likely to be surprised. And every day I say I wake up, I'm surprised if I'm not surprised, because science, the imagination of nature is so much greater than the imagination of human beings, that we would never be at the story that I tell here if we didn't have nature dragging us along, kicking and screaming. The physicists didn't invent this model because they liked it, because it's rather that at every stage nature surprised us, right from, of course, relativity, through quantum mechanics, and then through the amazing discoveries of the latter half of the 20th century. And that's the other aspect of that I wanted to talk about in this book, because people tend to think of the 20th century and they think of the first 20 years with relativity and quantum mechanics, 1905 to 1925, as the big two decades. But in fact, there are two other decades between 1955 and 1975 where I think future historians may say there was even a greater revolution, and it's unsung. Because at the beginning of that time, we understood one force of nature. There are four forces. By the end of that period, we understood three of those four forces exactly. as quantum theories and understood the mathematical symmetries that really underlie our universe. It was an amazing period, but one that so far has been unheralded.
And how about today? Where are we today?
Well, today we're confused. Well, maybe an appropriate place to be. Today we've done a lot in the sense, and I talk about the building of the Large Hadron Collider as a way of testing. And that is sort of the Gothic cathedral of the 21st century because it's amazing. It is the most complicated machine ever built. And what it has done, in fact, July 4th, now we're in Philadelphia, July 4th is an important day, but in fact, for the human race, July 4th is an important day because on July 4th, 2012, the announcement was made of the discovery of the Higgs particle, which really tells us that this weird picture of this field underlying all of empty space that affects our properties is really true. It was an amazing speculation, an intellectual house of cards that could have been wrong, but it was proved to be true. So we do have the Large Hadron Collider running. It's discovered the Higgs. The question is, what will it discover next? And the answer is, we don't know. We have a lot of ideas, and usually most of our ideas are wrong. But we don't know why that Higgs field froze in the early universe. Every time we make a new discovery, there are lots of new questions that are asked. And we're at the point where we're looking for some empirical evidence that can push us to the new stage. We're also about to launch the James Webb Space Telescope, which will look back to the first galaxies that ever formed. And so we just discovered gravitational waves. We're at a wonderful time where lots of new data is coming out, and we may be able to learn if we discover gravitational waves from the beginning of time. We'll actually be able to test our ideas about what the universe was like when it was a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second old. And I find that amazing. When I was a graduate student,
I don't even know how to think about that.
Yeah, well, I get paid to think about it.
I know. So what does that mean, a billionth of a billionth of a billionth?
Well, the universe was at that time, we think the universe went from our visible universe went from the size of a single atom. It's amazing to think of all of the energy and matter that's now in 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, squeezed into a region smaller than the size of an atom. But at that time, we think the universe suddenly puffed up and went from the size of an atom to the size of a basketball in a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second. It's called inflation. And we may be able to see remnant signals from that time, which will allow us to test. By the way, the great thing about one of the reasons as a particle physicist I got into cosmology is there's this great symbiotic relationship between the very small and the very big. Because our whole universe was once very small, what we understand, what we're learning about the fundamental forces at the small scales that I talk about in this book have implications for understanding of the universe on the larger scales. And similarly, we can use the universe as a particle physics experiment. And if we can test it at those early times, we'll test the physics on a scale that's much greater than we could test at the Large Hadron Collider. We'd have to build an accelerator whose radius was the Earth-Moon distance in order to be able to probe that kind of scale here on Earth. So that's why the universe is very useful.
That is Lawrence Krauss, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a theoretical physicist, author of a new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Lawrence Krauss. He's a theoretical physicist, director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. And we are talking about his new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Well, I'd love to have you read the prologue to your book.
Okay. In the beginning, there was light. But more than this, there was gravity. After that, all hell broke loose. This is how the story of the greatest intellectual adventure in history might properly be introduced. It is a story of science's quest to uncover the hidden realities underlying the world of our experience, which required marshaling the very pinnacle of human creativity and intellectual bravery on an unparalleled global scale. This process would not have been possible without a willingness to dispense with all kinds of beliefs and preconceptions and dogma, scientific and otherwise. The story is filled with drama and surprise. It spans the full arc of human history, and most remarkably, the current version isn't even the final one, just another working draft.
Which is interesting. I mean, both you and the Bible start with light.
Well, yeah. In fact, the light it is a theme that carries through the book. Our effort to understand the nature of light really has – has colored, if you've excused the pun, our entire understanding of the fundamental structure of matter and energy. And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. And it was fun to go through, as I say, from Plato, but then jumping to Maxwell and Faraday and then Einstein. And the great one characteristic of science, progress in science, is when things that on the surface look very different are seen to be different manifestations of the same thing. That's how you know you made progress. You simplified the world in some way. And Maxwell and Faraday made two forces, electricity and magnetism, showed they were really different manifestations of the same thing. And then Einstein, that implied for Einstein that space and time were different manifestations of the same thing. And then we learned in the 20th century that even two of the forces in nature, the electromagnetic force and this weird weak force, which is responsible for actually the processes of power of the sun that operates only on the scale of nuclei, whereas electromagnetism operates across the universe, are really different manifestations of precisely the same force. That kind of unification continues. And we think that eventually, potentially, at least three of the four forces in nature will be unified. That's what we're working on right now. And potentially all four forces, even having a quantum theory of gravity, might be unified together. That's part of the current global search.
In this book, you talk about a number of people whom you mentioned just there. In fact, Faraday, one of your heroes, and you go on, Newton, Galileo, and others.
They're all interesting characters.
They are. But you also talk about this guy named Paul Adrian Maurice Dirac. True confession, don't know who he is, but you had an interesting phone call with him. I know I should, and that's part of why you are here. Tell us about your phone call and why Dirac is important.
Dirac was one of the people who developed quantum mechanics. He was an amazing physicist, and he developed something called the Dirac equation, which is basically he was the one who unified relativity and quantum mechanics, and it changed the world in many ways. But Dirac was a very interesting fellow. He never talked much. He apparently didn't talk much until he was a few years old, and later on in life he didn't talk very much either.
Which makes for an interesting phone conversation.
Yeah,
right?
For an interesting phone conversation. He took everything literally and seriously. There's one famous story of him lecturing and someone saying, I don't understand this step in this equation on the board. And he just sat there and didn't say anything. And the person said, do you want to answer my question? He said, there wasn't a question there. But I was very intimidated. When I was a young student, I ran something called the Canadian Undergraduate Physics Association, which sponsored a big physics conference once a year with well-known people. It's where I first met Feynman. And I decided I wanted to invite Dirac. He was still alive. And I made the mistake of right after my quantum mechanics class, so I was really intimidated making a call to him. At the time, he was in Florida, and he answered the phone, which surprised me. And then I asked him if he would come to the conference. And again, there was silence for a minute or two. And then he said, I don't think I have anything to say to undergraduates.
Ouch. But you still have him on your pedestal, right?
He was a remarkable human being. He did many, many different things. And we should celebrate his accomplishments, of course. And the other neat thing about science, you see, interestingly, Feynman, who many of your listeners do know of, was an amazing scientist, also gregarious and charming. I actually wrote a book about Feynman. And the interesting thing is that Dirac was one of Feynman's heroes. And I find that fascinating because they're two individuals. You could not imagine two individuals who are more different than Feynman and Dirac. But that's what makes science so wonderful. The stereotypes of science are wrong. Science takes
geeky,
all types.
Nerdy types.
Yeah, it takes all types, all genders and all types. And when it's healthy, every one of those types can make a contribution. You don't even have to be a mathematical wizard. A lot of people think, oh, I'm not the best mathematics student in my class. I shouldn't go into physics. I have a lot of colleagues who are Nobel laureates who were certainly not the best mathematicians in their class. It's wonderful. It's an enterprise that can utilize the talents and creativity of people of all different types. And that's why I think young people should be encouraged to consider doing it. It's because the quest is remarkable and the community is remarkable too. And I often think nowadays young people tend to think of where they can get a job the most. And I always tell them, just do what you enjoy in school, and because you'll have a lifetime to do other things.
Well, Michael Faraday is one of your heroes, a man with little, as you write, formal schooling. He thought in pictures, which is interesting.
Yeah, in fact, his pictures changed the world. Faraday was a bookbinder's apprentice and wasn't formally educated.
A bookbinder's apprentice.
Yeah. And in fact, the interesting thing is he did something I tell my students. He created a precedent that they should all follow, which is to suck up to your professors. Because he went to the lectures of Humphrey Davy, who was the head of the Royal Institution, and he took very careful and beautiful notes, and then he bound them beautifully in a book, which he presented to Humphrey Davy and said, "Can I be your assistant?" And he became his assistant and later on moved on to become director of the Royal Institution and the greatest experimental physicist of the 19th century. And because he hadn't been trained in mathematics, he did think in pictures, and he created these pictures of electric and magnetic fields, which were just an invention of his mind that helped him picture what was going on. And then it turned out, as Maxwell later showed, that those fields were real. They're as real as the hand in front of your face, because you couldn't see the hand in front of your face without them, because those fields, a wave of electric and magnetic fields, is what light is. And it was an amazing process of discovery, which I try and talk about in the book.
You talk about, and you mentioned earlier that it's not about us being us human beings, that this, our existence, the universe, we are not at the center of that. And for some people, I have to say, I feel comfortable with that. For a lot of people, that is, then how do I live my life? How do I know to be a good person?
Well, you know, that's what amazes me. Why do people have to assume the universe is, it's incredibly, the notion that the universe exists so that we can exist, in my opinion, is very solipsistic. Not being at the center of the universe doesn't make our own particular lives less precious for us. It makes, in fact, them more precious. The fact that we're a cosmic accident, it's amazing that we've evolved, and I can still say that word, we've evolved a consciousness and a brain that can allow us to understand the universe at the earliest moments of expansion and explore it out to the farthest regions. It's amazing. We should celebrate that. And the fact that we are a cosmic afterthought should make us feel more special in a sense, that and make our time more precious. We have these facilities. It's great. Let's use them. Let's work and make the world a better place for us. I don't think you have to – if you think of the rest of life, you don't have to be the center of everything to enjoy things. Once again, when you go to a play, you don't have to be the center of the play to enjoy it. You enjoy the process, and you enjoy experiencing – a world that's different than your own. One of the great things that I hope people learn, one of the reasons for universities and for travel, is to experience the world differently than you did in your home, because it opens your mind. And to realize that the universe is quite different in general than our experience here opens our minds. And that, to me, is the process that makes being a human being worth being a human being.
Do you think of the Bible as alternative facts, the phrase of the day, which I'm not particularly comfortable with?
No, I wouldn't use the word facts there for the Bible. But I think
it's what, about belief?
Well, look, the Bible was an early attempt by people, by Iron Age people who didn't know the Earth orbited the sun, to understand the world around them, to understand a world that often seemed hostile and dangerous. And that's been around, I mean, since humans first evolved, early modern humans, the world does seem hostile and dangerous. Now, how can you make sense of it? And so it was perfectly reasonable to try and make sense of it. And in fact, there's a common thread in some sense to what the origins of science and, of course, the origins of religion. And that is that there's more out there than meets the eye. Mm-hmm. And in religion, you assume that there's this guiding force. But what science has taught us is there is more outside there than meets the eye. But you don't need to invent gods or angels. That the universe is incredible. We're a bit of cosmic pollution in a sea of dark matter and dark energy. All around us in empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles that popping in and out of existence. The world, the actual universe is amazing. And of course, so one can understand the Bible stories, and one can understand the hope that there's some guiding force in the universe. And science can't disprove that science can never disprove the supposition that there's purpose to the universe. But what we can say is there's no evidence of such purpose that we can see. And that's okay. But the actual Bible stories, the sun didn't stop in the sky when a horn was blown, those things were myths. And of course they're myths to try and, because people didn't know how the universe worked. The sun didn't go around the earth back, that's as they thought back then. And I understand what I'm saying right now may offend some people, but even Moses Maimonides used to say, the famous Jewish biblical scholar, he said the Bible is absolutely true, but if your interpretation of the Bible disagrees with the evidence of science, you should re-examine your interpretation of the Bible.
Oh, interesting. But is part of science being then comfortable with being uncomfortable? I mean, being willing to say, I don't know, I'm not sure why we are here, but we're here.
Yeah, well, you know, I once said, and I think I talked in the book, that I said that one of the purposes of science is to make us uncomfortable. And I thought, gosh, that's going to drive people away. But being uncomfortable is part of growing up. It's having a safe, secure environment where you think you know everything. One of the problems with religion is it assumes the answers before it asks the questions. Mm-hmm. And being able to step out and say, let me go to where the universe takes me, is uncomfortable. It's scary. It's terrifying at times. But so's growing up. So's leaving home. There's that famous phrase, a ship is safe in the harbor, but that's not what ships are built for. And so, of course, every time we learn something, it takes us out of our comfort zone. And that's the wonder and excitement that we shouldn't be afraid of. It scares me and worries me that some people would rather their children not know how the universe actually works than for fear that it will affect their faith. So parents don't want their kids to learn that evolution happened or that the Big Bang happened for some reason, because they fear it'll affect their faith. And boy, that's unfortunate. It's actually child abuse, in my opinion.
Oh, child abuse? Why?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not as dramatic a form of child abuse as other things. But anytime you withhold knowledge from your children that could help them become better adults and deal with a strange and wonderful world, you're harming them. You're inhibiting their capabilities as human beings. And we should all encourage, you know what? And speaking of comfort zones, one of the problems is we as parents and often as teachers are too shy to say, I don't know, or too embarrassed to say, I don't know. But we should all be proud. When a kid asks us a question we don't know, we should be willing to say, I don't know. Let's figure it out. Same with teachers. We all try and pretend we have the answers. But in fact, it'd be much more fun to say, you know, I don't know. Let's figure that out. Yeah.
Can you, though, you mentioned James Clerk Maxwell, mm-hmm. one of the scientists in your book, who was also deeply religious.
Yeah. Well, a lot of scientists early on were deeply religious. There's still some deeply religious scientists, not many anymore. But the point is that, you know, early on when Newton, for example, was going, religion was the only game in town. It was the National Science Foundation of the 16th century, because if you wanted to go to university, all universities were religious institutions. And so it's not surprising that the origins – and people often say, well, you know, the origins of science is in religion. And in some sense it is. But, you know, children outgrow their parents. And science grew out of that religious belief and later took us beyond it. And that's okay. It's not a bad thing. In fact, we often talk about a loss of faith as if it's a bad thing. In some sense, faith is the antithesis of science, because we take nothing on faith in science. If there isn't evidence for it, we're skeptical of everything and we question everything. That doesn't mean we don't want to be good people. You don't. One of the problems that I have is that religion has sort of subsumed morality in that sense. And I often say to people, if you didn't believe in God, would you go out and kill your neighbor? I think most people wouldn't. I've had audiences where every now and then a person puts
their
hand
scary.
Up. But I think our morality is based on reason as much as anything else. And of course, reason is a slave of passion. We try – in order – you can't – it may be true that you can't get to ought from is. But unless you know what is, you can never get to ought. If you don't know the implications of what you do, if you don't know how the world works, how can you act – ethically, because you don't know what the implications of your actions are. And so science is an important part of that.
Were you ever a quote-unquote person of faith?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid...
Were you raised in a religious household?
Not particularly religious, but I was raised in a Jewish household, and I wanted to believe. I think that's the key thing. We all want to believe. And when I was a kid, I read the Bible, and I also read the Quran, and those stories were neat. But eventually, I just sort of grew out of them, the same way I grew out of Santa Claus. It wasn't a catharsis I didn't have an epiphany. It was just slowly the real world. It was clear that those stories were just stories. And I kind of understood the context of those stories, but I didn't need them. Eventually, the real universe became more interesting. And of course, as studying the universe over the last 40 years, it's continually been more interesting and continually taught me that my presumptions are likely to be wrong. And so it's a wonderful thing to be – in fact, there's a lot of evidence in pedagogical research that the only way to really learn something is to confront your own misconceptions. And so I try and do that when I'm teaching physics all the time. And it's a wonderfully liberating experience to confront your own misconceptions. I often tell students that I hope sometime in their educational career at a high school or university, there's some concept that they take as very dear and central to their being that they discover is wrong. Because it opens your mind. And that's a wonderful experience that all of us have in one way or another. But too often, in certain areas of human experience, including religion, somehow people think that something that confronts what you currently believe that changes is a bad thing. And it's not a bad thing if it's true.
If it's, well, of course. Yeah. And then the question is, will it then become untrue, you know?
Well, no, but one of the biggest misconceptions about science is that scientific revolutions do away with everything that went before them. That's not the way it works. What has confronted experiment and is true, and by that I mean, say, take Newton's laws. You know, they're great for baseballs or cannonballs or even rocket ships now. Now, we know that Newton's laws are not true absolutely in the sense that at small scales, quantum mechanics takes over. At the largest scales, general relativity is relevant. But now and forever, if I have a ball and I let it go, it's going to fall. And anything I learn about quantum gravity is not going to change that. So whatever new theories we have are not going to change what already is a good explanation that's satisfied by experiment. It just enlarges it and makes it grow. So people too often think that, well, you know, science is a fad and everything we think is true today will be wrong tomorrow, so why should I learn about it? That's not the way it works.
And that is Lawrence Krauss, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, theoretical physicist, author of a new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. The last time he was on the show, we talked about a previous book, A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. You can comment or call, I should say, or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Lawrence Krauss is our guest. He's a theoretical physicist, and he's also the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. Let me read some comments here. One from Paul. Where does all the water come from? A lot of ice asteroids over a long time. Is that it?
Well, it is an interesting question that we're only sort of beginning to think we really understand, but because when the Earth formed in the solar system, the temperature in that region was about 1,000 degrees. So it was very hot. Volatiles like water are not easily stored. And so where the water on Earth comes from is an interesting question. Now, comets have, in fact, delivered enough water to the Earth over its history to account for all the oceans. But The isotopic abundance of water, of deuterium in water, is in the oceans is different than many comets. So people thought, well, okay, maybe the comets aren't doing it. We've now discovered a new set of comets that have a closer isotopic ratio. But the interesting question is whether, in fact, water was actually stored in the rocks that formed the Earth. And actually whether a significant fraction of the Earth's water was, in fact, there when the Earth formed. And one of the ways we're trying to understand that is to not look at water on Earth, but to go to Mars.
Right.
Because Mars doesn't have volcanism, and in fact, we're looking at the primordial water in some sense when we measure the water on Mars. And so when we look at Mars, we'll learn a lot about the Earth, which is one of the reasons to study those planets.
A question from Paul. Thanks for sending us that question. A tweet from Joni. What light does Higgs shed on consciousness? We talked earlier about Higgs. Keep it short if you can.
Yeah.
If
the answer is it's a long way from Higgs to consciousness. In fact, the answer is we really don't know what consciousness is. What the Higgs particle is makes consciousness possible, because the Higgs field is this field everywhere in space that particles that make up your and my body move through, and it changes their properties so that we can actually exist. So the Higgs field, in some sense, is responsible for our existence. But after that, the road to consciousness is a long way. And I often tell people the reason I do physics is because it's easy. Consciousness is a much harder question. But the important thing to point out also when it comes to the Higgs field is it sounds ridiculous to say there's an invisible field everywhere. It almost sounds religious, right? Responsible for our existence. And it would be religious, except for the fact that claim had to be substantiated. If we claim that there's this invisible field everywhere, we have to find it. And it turns out in quantum mechanics, for every field, there's a particle. And if you slap empty space hard enough, in a single point, you should kick out particles. And that's what the Large Hadron Collider was built to do. Mm-hmm. That incredible edifice was built to try and test, and indeed we discovered those particles existed. So we don't assume invisible things that affect us and then just let it go at that.
Another tweet, what will work debunking anti-science junk?
Well, I think the way to debunk anti-science junk, as I say, is to get people to understand the scientific process, to tell, which helps us sift sense from nonsense, to look for empirical evidence from many sources, from different sources, to test your ideas. Those things are what we need to debunk the alternative facts and the other kind of nonsense, pseudoscientific nonsense and political nonsense. And so it's the same process. And that's why I think science is relevant for everyday life, not just beyond the wonder that it describes, because the process is useful to all of us.
Why is it important to know that human beings are radioactive? As you write that you learned this in high school, I obviously went to the wrong high school.
Well, the particles that make us up, neutrons, are the dominant particle in our bodies. And most people would be just surprised to discover that neutrons have a lifetime of 10 minutes. Now, you and I, you will notice, and some of your listeners will have noticed, that we've been here longer than 10 minutes and we're still around.
Yes.
And it is an amazing accident of existence that neutrons, free neutrons, will decay in 10 minutes, but you put them in a nucleus and they won't decay at all in most nuclei, and some of them they will, and those are radioactive nuclei. And the reason for that is remarkable, and it's, of course, in my book.
So why are we here?
Well, the answer is that there's no obvious reason, that it seems to be an accident, that our existence is this accident, just like it's as significant, as I say, as those ice crystals on that window pointing in a certain direction. If a field hadn't frozen in early history of the universe in a certain way, the conditions of the universe would not allow our existence. And that is remarkable. And so there is no obvious reason why we're here. And just like you can create a universe from nothing without supernatural shenanigans, our existence can arise by a wonderful and amazing series of cosmic, in some sense, accidents. And you look, in the end result is it looks like the universe is designed for us. But in fact, you know, it's not. In fact, it looks like it's fine-tuned for our existence. But we are fine-tuned for the universe, not the other way around. Just like Darwin showed with evolution, the bees can see the colors of flowers not because they're designed to do it, but because if they couldn't, they wouldn't survive. And in some sense, it's not surprising that the universe appears to have all the properties necessary for our existence, because we couldn't have arisen in the universe if it didn't have those properties. And of course, the alternative is also true. If the universe had different properties, then we can't. Who knows what could arise in that universe? It could be that intelligence could arise in that universe of a very different form. And that kind of intelligence would be saying, isn't it amazing the universe has these properties just for us?
But you're saying it wouldn't be us.
No, it wouldn't be us.
If it were different properties, it would not be us.
It would not be us, but you could still have intelligence. It's like saying, isn't it amazing that my feet reach all the way exactly to the ground?
Let me read an email from Janet. Isn't the most amazing things that the fact that our brains are part of the as part of the universe can understand the universe?
It is amazing. It is remarkable that we've evolved this consciousness. And in my institute, the Origins Project, we just had a workshop on artificial intelligence and the future of artificial intelligence. And it's also terrifying, but also wonderful. And it's going to teach us a lot about consciousness in general. But understanding the brain is right now one of the forefronts, of course, of science, and it's a very we don't yet. But isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing that you and I are here and we can have this discussion?
Yep.
And we should celebrate that fact. And every day we learn more about how the process began from the beginning of the universe through the creation of matter to eventually the origin of life and consciousness. And it's a wonderful story. And it keeps changing, as I say.
You mentioned at the very end of your book that you wrote the end of your book while sitting at Christopher Hitchens' desk. I think you were at his widow's apartment or house.
At the house, at your family home. Yeah, Christopher was a friend of mine. And when I was getting near the end of it, I had to be in San Francisco. And Carol Blue, Christopher's wife, kindly asked if I would stay at the house. And I was supposed to attend a meeting, but the attraction of Christopher's office to finish the book was just too great. And I tried to channel him, although even though I know that is, of course, not scientific.
You need some liquor to be able to do that, don't you?
Maybe. But it was an honor to be there, and it was an honor to have been Christopher's friend, and it's a loss for everyone. And it was fun to talk to Christopher about science. We did all the time when I was there, and he was going to write the prologue for the Universe from Nothing, but he died before it was finished, and that was sad for me and sad for everyone.
I remember interviewing him, and he described himself as an anti-theist. Mm-hmm. Which is different, I think, from being an atheist.
Well,
Which one are you? How do you describe yourself?
You know, when Christopher said anti-theist, that resonated with me because I could say what I could say is that, and I used to say is that I don't know, I can't prove there's no God, but I could certainly say I would rather live in a universe that didn't have one. But now I think my attitude is evolved. I'm more an apatheist.
You don't care.
Well, God is irrelevant. God never comes up. I've been a physicist for 40 years. You never hear the word mentioned in physics meetings. To understand the universe, God turns out to be, as far as we can see, irrelevant. And so there's a big hoopla about, you know, science and God, and people make it seem as if it's an important question. It never comes up in scientific meetings. And so,
It mean you don't care? I mean, I hear the word apathy in that.
Well, the issue is not important to me when I'm trying to understand the universe. Of course, as a human being, I'm more than just a scientist, and that question comes up. And as I say, the fact that there's no evidence for God makes me not only suspect there's no God, but most people say, well, I'm not. Or a lot of people say I'm not an atheist, but I'm agnostic. But if you think about it, agnostics are atheists. Mm. Because agnostics are those people who say, the story doesn't convince me. And that's really what atheist is. It's basically saying the story of the Bible or the Quran or whatever the sacred book you might follow isn't sufficiently convincing to me that I believe that is the case. And so really, those people who say that are really atheists. And then the word, unfortunately, has an awful connotation in our society. And it shouldn't, because it just means we're questioning. I wrote a piece in the New Yorker called Why All Scientists Should Be Militant Atheists. And what I meant by that was whenever I just ask the question, is there a God, you know, or maybe suggest that there might not be, I'm called a militant atheist, which amazes me because asking questions is not militant. It's what we should encourage in everyone. And nothing should be sacred. Nothing should be above questioning in an open society, including those things that are sensitive, and that's particularly important in our political process right now.
And that's Lawrence Krauss, and you can join the conversation. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Mm-hmm. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read what Bob says in an email. Is there a possibility that another Big Bang will occur?
That's a good question. We see our universe expanding, and the big question was, will it eventually contract into a big crunch, the opposite of the Big Bang, and then maybe reoccur again? The evidence right now suggests probably not, that our universe will go on expanding forever, probably. In fact, it's expanding faster and faster, which is one of the amazing things I talked about in my last book. And if that's the case, it'll go on expanding forever. And by the way, in that case, the future is truly miserable because every galaxy we now see will disappear in the far future, it'll be our galaxy alone in a vast, dark universe. But the good news is we can't say that for certain because the expansion of the universe is dominated by this energy of empty space. And we really don't understand what that is. And until we understand what that is, we really can't say what it'll do in the future. Mm-hmm. And so there is a cosmic mystery, and that's a fun thing.
Let me hear what Mark from Philadelphia has to say, and let's play his comment.
Mark from Philadelphia. Could Dr. Krauss please explain the strongest arguments in favor of the theory of intelligent design and then provide the strongest arguments against the theory of intelligent design? Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Can you argue in favor of intelligent design?
No, that's the problem. It's not as if it's a theory that's comparable to anything else. It's not a theory. It's not a scientific idea at all. I mean, it is in principle a scientific idea, but it's been proved to be wrong. The notion, is there some evidence that the evolution of diversity in life on Earth required something intelligence to guide us? And you could ask, is there any evidence of that? And the answer is no. Every time we've been able to test evolution, it's satisfied the test. So intelligent design isn't a theory that's comparable to evolution, and it shouldn't be compared as a theory. It's just not scientific at all. Hmm. There's no need to discuss it because it doesn't work. And moreover, evolution is probably one of the best tested scientific ideas of all time.
Let me play another person who called our comment line, and this is Joe.
How you doing? My name is Joe. I'm calling from Collinswood. And I just have a question, I guess, slash comment for the guest. He said previously that religion assumes the answers before it even asks the questions. Well, my comment, I guess, slash question is, isn't he doing the same thing with his preconceptions or his conceptions of the Big Bang and evolution?
And evolution.
No, I'm not doing the same thing at all, because each of them could be wrong. We didn't develop the Big Bang because we sat in a room and decided we liked the idea. The universe told us there was a Big Bang. We look and see the universe is expanding. We can work backward and make predictions about things that we haven't measured before and then test them to see if they're wrong. And at any stage, if those predictions were wrong, we'd throw the theory out like yesterday's newspaper. That's what's wonderful. There's no idea that's so beautiful that we can't throw it out. And the Big Bang, it was debated for a long time, but then we discovered the cosmic microwave background. We measured the age of the universe. Everything fits together. And similarly, evolution is, again, an idea that was an interesting idea that's been tested. And if there was any evidence that went against it, we throw it out. Most people don't realize that if you're a scientist, the way to become sort of famous is to prove your colleagues wrong. You want to go in every day and prove your colleagues wrong, because that leads us in new directions. And so we don't come to this consensus as if, you know, we have these secret rings and robes. It's something that nature drives us to. And that's the complete difference. Opening your mind and let nature tell you where to go rather than decide you know what the answer is.
We don't have time for the description that this question deserves, but you had a really fascinating story about a young refugee from Afghanistan, a woman who was self-taught, uh-huh, wanted to come to the United States. This was in when the first refugee ban was announced. But the story is not so much about the refugee ban, but about this young woman who was just deterred. Is absolutely determined to be a scientist.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. She wasn't allowed to go to school after age 11 because she was a girl, and she taught herself English and then physics and then and mathematics, and she, my books had affected her. Happily, she had the internet, which is great for people. And the great news is that she's now studying in the United States, which, wow, I think is, I didn't think she'd be alive today to do it. And the point is that she is the future. Young women like her who are excited, and we should be opening our doors to the best young people in the world, because that's what has helped make this country what it is. If we look at the key people who've been here, many of them came from elsewhere. And one of the reasons that we're still in good economic shape is that our graduate schools right now attract the best young people in the world. Some of them stay here, some of them go home. But if we close our doors, then we're hurting our country. And it's a sad thing to think that there are many talented young people who would come here, contribute to the United States, or might go back home and contribute to their countries and improve them. And when we turn them away because of myopia, it's a problem.
Lawrence Krauss, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. The book is called The Greatest Story Ever Told. And you can catch up with our guest. He's speaking tonight at 7 at the Ethical Humanist Society in Center City, Philadelphia. Yes, that is Gustav Holst, The Planets, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, recording of Jupiter, the Bringer of Jollity. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.